Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 310 featuring Kirsten Zerngibel, who is an incredible, she is an artist. You know, we say she's a concept artist, illustrator, game developer, et cetera, et cetera. But she at her heart of hearts is a true artist. That's absolutely, she's such a cool cat. I love Kirsten. She's so fun. Kirsten, what do you think about the podcast with her?
It's amazing. I said, like, she's like the epitome of smart. She's just like how her mind works is like, it's it's just amazing. Like all the stuff she's doing, and she's creating this, her game. It's called Intopolis. I'm not sure I'm saying it right, but it's like where players assume the role of an art historian from the distant future. Then they're tasked with finding patterns and detailed otherworldly artworks. So just that's one thing she does. And then all the art and images she creates. Yeah, it's been fun seeing her work over the last few months since I've known about her.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was a guest on our 24 Hours of Chaos, and she started just talking about all of our art. And there's basically just such a vast amount of stuff inside of her head that she needs to express itself in the art world. And she uses a lot of interesting things in CG, and has been using CG as part of her art world and her creativity arsenal. And it's been really fascinating to see that. And I'm actually really happy. If you guys are interested in hearing more about that kind of creative mind, go back and listen to my Kevin Mack episodes. I've done a couple with Kevin Mack, and he's very similar ideas in terms of his perception and what VR means and all of those other things in terms of his creative blend. Really cool guys. I mean, Kirsten is absolutely incredible, and I really loved having her on. And I definitely encourage you guys to go to her site and check out all the amazing stuff that she's done, because she's really cool. And you can tell by the way she talks, she's got like a lot of stuff that needs to be expressed. And I just love listening to her. I could definitely hang out with her for a while. So thank you so much, Kirsten, for being on and telling us all about the cool creative stuff that you've been doing. All right. Kirsten, not Kirsten. can you tell us a little bit about what's going on at Chaos Group?
Yeah. So Vantage is out, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And then we have a competition with that. It's called Building Utopia. And you can, it actually ends January 25th. So that's the last day to submit. And you can find that out at buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com.
That's great. Yeah. Actually, for those of you who don't know, Vantage is what used to be called Project Lavina. And Vantage is now our standalone fully ray-traced real-time platform that we're creating, where you can bring in your VR scenes and be able to see them in real-time, fully ray-traced. And with that, we decided to kick off a competition, which we're partnering with Lenovo and NVIDIA and Kitbash 3D and, of course, CG Architect. And we're all getting together to create this Building Utopia competition. So go to buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com to check out the competition and get all the materials you need, including a free license of Vantage. Vantage is going to be free for a little bit, so you guys can take advantage of that now. And it is, again, this is last date of the competition is January 25th. So it's a week from when this podcast comes out. So we're going to have 7 days, which, by the way, you should be able to commit to do a really great submission in 7 days, because Vantage itself is a very fast renderer, so you'll be able to do that. But love to see your ideas. So remember, that's buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com, and the deadline is January 25th. All right, we have one more thing. What else is going on?
Yes, V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D is out now.
Yeah, that's right. Cinema 4D, as you guys know, is a very popular package, and V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D is our first foray where it comes straight from the Chaos Group guys. So it's written by the Chaos Group guys, and it's fully supportive of all the V-Ray 5 features, which is really great, and I'm sure you guys are really going to enjoy it. So all of you C4D guys, go ahead and check it out. V-Ray 5 for C4D. You probably get a trial license if you'd like to try it out. And would love to see what your feedback is. And it also supports all the GPU stuff. All the things that you guys in the C4D world have been waiting for is now supported in V-Ray 5 for C4D. All right, cool. Kirsten, if people want to know more about the podcast, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
perfect. And if you guys have any ideas of other great, cool guests to have on a podcast, please let us know. labs@chaosgroup.com is the email to email us. If you have any feedback of any kind, just go ahead and put it there. If you're listening to us on your iDevice, go ahead on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review and a rating. Share us with your friends. We'd love to know about that too. As you guys know, also, we are these podcasts are now in video format. You can see us on our Facebook page, which is, as Kristen said, facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, as well as our YouTube page, which is just our YouTube channel is Chaos Group TV, and that's on YouTube. So you can see all the video formats on there as well. All right. That being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Kristen Zerngabel.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Hey, so okay, yeah. So you're setting up your background. You're doing your thing. You do this. I mean, I remember last time when you were on our 24 Hours of Chaos, you'd mentioned that you're starting to do you're doing Twitch too, right?
Yes.
Nice. Okay.
I took kind of a hiatus from it for a couple of reasons. One of them being I've been doing a lot of personal R&D lately, and I thought people might really not care to watch me looking at documentation and toggling boxes and does this work? Does that work?
Right.
You know, I went away until I've got a bit more streamlined with some of my new tools. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to stream and get input from the people watching. And it kind of shows how you can think on your feet. And I've been really interested in streaming the ideation process. I think that's really missing from the Steam community right now. It's popular to, you know, paint a very shiny rendered image because, you know, it looks good and there's a magic to it, especially for non-artists, but to really show the decision-making process, you know, the way in which one can create conceptual handholds and footholds to jump to better ideas is like, I really want to do more of that. So
that's really interesting that you say that. And I want to definitely get into that, but I think for a lot of people on a podcast, I always tend to jump timelines a little bit. That's going to be where we're going to head to, but let's start from the beginning of where this comes from. You are an incredible artist and have been passionate about art, obviously very passionate about art and about amazing things that are coming out of your head that you need to express visually. Where did that come from? Where did your art inspiration come from? How did that all sort of start? What is the genesis of this thing that's pouring out of you?
That's a hard question to answer. There are certain things that I've just always been attracted to, that my brain is just comfortable with and is drawn to. And one of my very earliest memories is I did a lot of drawing on like a magna doodle. And I remember one of my earliest memories was drawing this like kaleidoscopic geometric shape on the magna doodle. And so I've always really been drawn to pattern and symmetry. And I spent a lot of time in nature as a kid. I had this big woods behind my house, and I just did a lot of solitary exploring, and I just developed a love of plants there.
And where was this?
This is in Ohio.
In Ohio, okay.
Northeast Ohio, small town in Ohio. Yep. And I was just always I had this thing, you can almost call it a complex, for wanting to have something to show for my time. This, like, you know, I call it almost like a time crystal. It's like I was always making things, you know, with construction toys, or I did a lot of crafting. And I really think that especially the crafting hones this love of pattern and intricacy. But I just love being able to look at where my time was spent and hold it and rotate it around. And, you know, it's just, you know, it was just kind of a thing. But yeah, I, um, I was creative in other ways. You know, I played a couple instruments. I made videos a little later in my childhood. I stop motion, stuff like that. But I really, I'm a very visual thinker. I'm a very visual person. So visual art was always like the cornerstone of my creative self.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So art was always part of you. You were always creating things. You always felt you needed to express yourself in some way visually.
Absolutely.
I can tell. It's always been, it's amazing to see your work. And it's like, this is someone who has a lot in her brain and it needs to come out in a visual way. And I think it's really, really interesting. So did you go to school or did you just dive right into it? Like, no, I'm just going to make this stuff on my own.
So back up a little bit, I did a lot of art in high school. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really doing a lot of, I didn't play a lot of video games. I watched a lot of shows. I was very serious about academics. I was very, I did a lot of solitary producing. So I feel like I did a lot of my artistic development actually before art school. Okay. And that ended up, so later in high school, I also became a lot more interested in engineering. I mathematics is something that I had always enjoyed and was good at, and I wanted to find some way that I could be creative, but also, you know, solve problems.
Okay.
And I ended up doing a pre-college program for engineering and realized it was not what I thought it would be. Yeah, I had this, I really wanted to be like this kind of, I've always had this kind of lone wolf creator kind of a complex. I've been getting out of it lately, but back then I really wanted to like make something, be an inventor, make something cool all on my own. And I realized that modern engineering is all about being part of a very large team and, working on a very small part. A lot of it is optimization rather than like creating something brand new.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I discovered right at the end of high school, I discovered concept art as a profession. And that really, like, you know, I discovered conceptart.org, just all the amazing work and digital art. I didn't know about digital art.
Oh, so you were doing all of this was analog before. You were doing painting. And what was your medium that you were using mainly?
All kinds. I did oil paint. I did like Flemish old masters oil painting. I did watercolor and pen, really tiny, like intricate work. I had way more patience back then. I think that migrating to digital has actually given me less patience in some ways. And that ended up really helping me. All that time I spent in high school, I ended up in a situation where I could have a full scholarship to this art college, Columbus College of Art and Design.
Yeah.
And so I discovered concept art and the whole world of like video game development. And I'd always wanted to create worlds. Like that was something when I was a kid, I also wrote and I would, you know, I was very world-based. I feel like world building is a state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I discovered concept art, I'm like, this is it. Like I can design robots and not have to worry about what their gaskets cost, you know, like in engineering. I can make 10 of them a day and just as long as think about how they'd work just enough to have fun with it and not get tied up in the actual manufacture. And so it was like the best of all worlds. But there were no programs for concept art. Like, you know, the school that I had the scholarship with, they only had illustration. So that's what I took.
Right.
And so I really, in a lot of ways, it was not the right program for me.
Okay.
But I think that it helped me because it gave me deadlines. I'm very much an explorer. And if I'm not given a certain deadline, I will keep iterating. I would just keep doing stuff. And so I just tried to make the assignments my own. You know, they would give us children's book illustrations, the things that I wasn't as interested in, but I would find some way to twist the, I turned into kind of like an assignment lawyer. I'd twist the parameters of the assignment into something that I was passionate about.
Sure.
And I would use tools that they, you know, I actually started getting into 3D and was self-taught in 3D, you know, as part of that program and just was using that to complete my assignments.
Okay.
And so I feel like, you know, it was in some ways self-taught, but in other ways, I guess.
Right. And then, Brian, what year was this? Let's just, I know what kind of technology you were dealing with at that time.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So this was like 2007, 2008, 2009. I graduated early from that program to do a different program.
Okay.
I graduated, in 2010. My first 3D program was Bryce.
Seems about right.
Yeah. Oh man, what that was great. It was a total God feeling. It's like, I am carving away like tons of rock with a single brush, right. You know, it was like, I was hooked, when I discovered 3D. I moved to Modo, after that. Mm-hmm. So graduated early from that program because there was a actual entertainment design program. I really wanted to do concept art that opened up. It was based around conceptart.org forums. Mm-hmm. And like, that was the first thing that like introduced me to concept art. So I had this kind of a tie to it. So I did that for a couple of years, and I was freelancing while I was in school as well. Doing like RPG illustrations, sort of like tabletop gaming stuff and some advertising work. I was interested in industrial design in school as well. Nobody told me industrial design was a thing when I was saying I wanted to be an engineer, which would have been a great way to reconcile with my interest.
Sure.
So I did some of that work, after graduating, and I've done kind of a little bit of everything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I remember actually when I was in architecture, I was an architect and I was doing architecture, and I actually realized I didn't care. It was similar to you. I didn't actually care that much about the buildings. I liked doing the images of the buildings, you know, whether they're built or not, it wasn't as important to me. I mean, not that I don't appreciate good architecture and everything else. It's just that there's, you know, I don't need to worry about the gaskets. It's the same idea, right? And it's
exactly.
Really more important to get the ideas out. But you seem to have obviously found a niche for yourself in terms of the kind of stuff that you did. So how did you make that journey from after graduating to doing a few jobs here and there to sort of becoming the artist that you are right now?
Yeah. How do I answer that? For one thing, I think something that helped accelerate me finding my voice was that I've only freelanced this whole time.
Right.
I have done contract work where I've flown to studios and worked, you know, a month doing concept, but I've never been so entrenched in a certain project or a certain institution. So I think that helped me stay nimble and open to new ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there are downsides to that too, for sure. But I do think that kind of helped me find my creative identity, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of exploring in the sketchbook, and that really helped to cement my form language. I'm constantly exploring, experimenting, and tinkering. So I started using 3ds Max several years ago at this point. It was around 5. I found that it was kind of a building process, in that I would create assets for my own work or for client works, and I would then remix those assets in a way that was pleasing to me and use those for, you know, another piece, and then recycle all the assets from that piece and remix those. And that act of remixing really helped me kind of kind of land on what really worked for me.
Right. So you did a lot of freelance work, and you were working for different groups of people. What kind of freelance work were you doing? I know you worked some stuff in games, and can you tell us a little bit, some examples of some of the stuff you've done?
Yeah. So really early on, I did some work for Riot Games, like flash illustrations, and like it was like a paid internship kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Flash illustrations and creature design, and it really wasn't my thing. At least I got it out of my system.
Okay.
And I got to feel like, you know, I did work for a well-known game company. I checked that box.
Okay.
I did work and still am doing some work for Magic the Gathering, the card game.
Yeah.
So illustration work for them, but also concept art. They have a lot of world building they've been doing recently.
Interesting.
So So between that, I've done like scientific illustration, brain science stuff. So that was interesting. I've done, like I said before, industrial design work.
Yeah.
There was a startup that was doing these VR arcades a few years ago, and they wanted like the hardware design for how everything would, the scaffolds and all that. I've done some theme park design work, like mostly theme parks in China. I don't even know which theme parks. They were very secretive. it was kind of strange. And one of my favorite projects I did was for Google, actually. They're like kind of Skunkworks division. They were working on something cool. And that was probably my favorite because it was totally blue sky, like kind of the game design part. I was as much of a game designer as I was like coming up with the visuals.
Right.
So I really, really love that. Lately, I've been working on an augmented reality theme park startup kind of project.
Okay.
That's been really cool. Because again, it's like when you're on the ground floor, you get to have a lot more input than just aesthetics. Like actually
yeah.
talk about like, how is this thing going to work? And that's really where I love being. So yeah, I'm probably missing some stuff, but that's kind of an overview.
That's a lot of really cool work. I mean, I like the fact that you're so diverse and you do a lot of different things in all of these different areas. It's really great. It's really, really cool.
Thank you.
But obviously you do a lot of personal work. You know, if you go to your site, there's a ton of personal work in there, and you mentioned the word world building, and it's very obvious that you have a world that lives inside of your imagination that you're putting out there and illustrating and putting a lot of detail into those ideas too. I mean, what is inspiring that? Where does that come from? I know obviously it's a lot of it's in your imagination, but how does that come? Where did this world come from? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Boy, that's a good question. And the world is kind of, it's a bit of a part of my identity at this point. And it's this current world that I'm working on. So I'm also working on a video game. That is the primary focus of mine for this coming probably 2 years. That's based on this world. But the world actually started over a decade ago. And I've been just iterating on it. It's changed a lot in a lot of ways, but there's still a thread going through it. It's really interesting. I've always felt that I needed to create this reality or some kind of a platform for all my creations to live in. It wasn't enough for me to just make an image or make a concept and put it out there. I want this home for right. all those things. I'm trying to think that there was no media growing up that had a world I fell in love with exactly. But the idea of virtual worlds was very interesting to me. So I played MMO RPG games, and that that idea of because that was as close to me, you know, as creating a world as you could get.
Right.
Because you had all these conscious entities in one place. And to me, as long as you have, you know, if you have multiple agents that have that some kind of consciousness or free will and that can all look at something and agree on it, it's a world.
Right.
You know, it's like So I guess I could say that was maybe kind of influential, but I don't really know where the desire to create worlds itself actually comes from. It just felt like it's always been there.
Right. Yeah. But
I feel like,
go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I feel like world building is like I said earlier, it's kind of a state of mind, and that I think I understand this world by world building in my head. I will look at something and imagine a world in which that thing is unusual or commonplace and just kind of build out from there. And so it's like I use hypotheticals to try to understand the actual world that we're in. So I feel like the mental process of making a model,
mm-hmm.
you know, when a person is making a decision and they're going back in their history, and they're looking at their past experiences, they build a model from those experiences, and then they almost use it as a simulation. You're running that model to figure out, you know, future possibilities and help make decisions.
Right.
And I think that I'm very aware of that process. I have synesthesia and ideesthesia, and I can kind of actually see the past and the future as like these structures. And I think I can just take that.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, a little bit. Okay. It's a little difficult to put into words, and I've played around with expressing it in art, but I have this thing I call time forms, whereas like I'll see the state of the system as a 2D thing, but I use time as the third dimension. So as that system, as different possibilities branch outward, I see, I see it branch. Like I can see the thing break apart into different ways something can go. And so when I look into the past, it's almost like I'm a tree and like the past is like roots. I can see all the different things that came together to make what I'm feeling, what I'm assessing right now. So I am the trunk, I am the now. Mm-hmm. And then I can see like, different ways things can go in the future,
right.
As these kinds of branching possibilities. And I have like three modes. I have like room mode, landscape mode, and object mode. It's a little difficult to put into words.
It's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. I think it's a really interesting way of thinking. I mean, you mentioned earlier, just briefly, that you had a passion for math and some of the things in the past, and it was very clear when I saw your work. I was a math major in college, so I have
cool.
And I had a lot of those similar thoughts. Honestly speaking, I'm just going to tell you, it's not unusual the way you're thinking, because when I was was studying mathematics, and I was especially studying things like topology and non-Euclidean geometry and things of that nature. Those, when you start thinking about those things, it starts to, I don't want to say warp your brain, but it basically makes you start to think about things, especially multiple dimensions, in a very different way. And it's a very interesting way of thinking about, like, well, why does a hypercube exist the way it does? Or why does it, why do these things exist the way they do? And it's really,
yeah.
And the way you described yourself as the tree, or the trunk of the tree, more specifically, as the now, and the past as the roots, and the future as a branch, I think is actually it's a pretty clear illustration. To me, at least, it's a very clear illustration. Now, what's interesting is how you turn that into your art, right? I mean, obviously, you're looking at things and you're like, okay, how does that become part of the art? That's something that I think is very interesting, is that you're iterating based on the past and where you think the future is. Is that the best way that I can sort of summarize some of that?
I don't think it translates that much to my art. It's more of me trying to explain why I'm interested in world building.
Okay.
Was that. Yeah. As for my art, I can tell you some of my influences are the things that inspire me, because that's maybe a better way to answer the question.
Let's do that.
yeah, sounds good. So one thing I really love and bring into my work a lot is modular design. And maybe it was all that beading and all that Lego and connects and putting little things together. But to me, it's such a beautiful idea to have a lot of these very versatile small parts that you can put together to assemble into, much bigger, more complicated things. I love that process of that. I was inspired a lot by microbiology, like organic chemistry. I was interested in that in high school. And so again, that kind of molecular, the stuff that goes on at that level, I really love in my art to have this kind of scale-free approach to things, where I might have a very vast scape, but it looks kind of like something you'd see under an electron microscope. Like I love that kind of playing with scale. I'm incredibly inspired by fractals. So especially like 3D fractals, I discovered and was playing with the Mandelbulb like 10 years ago. And even though I don't often use it like directly in my work, I feel like I've internalized 3D fractals, and sort of just, they were so meaningful to me when I discovered them, because they were so incredibly familiar. I think that I see those shapes in my mind's eye. Just when thinking, and they're almost like artifacts of thinking. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they drive my thought. I think that when I saw them, I saw like you can, with a really simple formula, you can generate these. It was actually more of a spiritual experience than anything.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. I feel like they permeate the work I make. And I even have different ways of bringing them in that are a little more circuitous than just, you know, rendering or exporting one of them and bringing it in. So that's a part of my work. I'm inspired a lot by modern architecture. I really love tent-style architecture. I've been getting into one of the themes in the world I'm working on right now is sort of like high-tech nomadism. And mm-hmm. the idea of like moving around is having a very dynamic environment that requires change. So having lightweight structures that can be disassembled and reassembled very easily. You can see a lot of great examples of that in like sort of the festival scene, like Burning Man, and that, you know, they have these big, like the way they do sound stages. I think that's really inspiring. So I bring some of that into my work. And then again, like coming full circle to early childhood, just like beading and weaving, I'm basically doing digital beading with rail clone and, you know, different tools. What are some of the other influences? Just procedural design in general. I look at the stuff being done in Houdini and Grasshopper, and sort of where biology meets math.
Yeah.
That's
fascinating. Yeah. There was a couple of philosophers, Deleuze and Guattari. They're French, and they wrote a whole sort of segment about nomadic life and nomadic architecture and what that means.
Cool.
And so that was something I was studying in architecture school for a while, honestly. And it was very interesting to think about what that means. I think that, you know, fractals are obviously, I mean, all of these things that you're saying are very, I can see them very directly in your work, and I can admit, I was like, yep, that makes sense. That's really great. And I think that the world building that you're doing, and, you know, I know you said you separate your art from your world building in terms of the way you're describing it, but your art is world building. You are building worlds in your art. And I think it's very, while it is a still, as you mentioned, when I look at it, it looks like a place that it is a place I want to go to, right? I mean, as a destination. So therefore, in my mind, it isn't static. It's not two-dimensional. It is very three-dimensional in a lot of ways. It's also very evolutionary, it seems, as well. Like you are constantly evolving it, right? So you don't necessarily see it as static. Am I right in assuming that?
Oh, absolutely. that's very perceptive. Absolutely. It's as I mentioned before. Feedback loops are. There's a whole bunch of feedback loops going on when I make my work. And when you mention evolutionary, like one of the simplest ones is just like, you know, you create something. Like to me, there's a feedback loop between depiction and description.
Okay.
Is I will have an idea of something that, you know, and I'll draw it. And but just by looking at the drawing, I will see some artifact of the drawing or something that I hadn't thought of and go, what could this do? Like putting the form down will often inform its function. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go, okay, I'll make another iteration of it, and I'll with that function built in, and I'll realize, oh wait, this creates this new problem that, you know, now I have to solve it with the next iteration. And so, it's totally, kind of a dance between those two factors.
Yeah, that's a good way of doing it. That's a really good way of doing it. I remember, you know, again in architecture school, I think there was something that I was dealing with, I was doing my thesis and I was having a hard time. Like I had an idea for my thesis, which my advisor said, that's been done before, it's boring, try something else. And I'm like, but this was my whole idea. And I was really upset about it, by the way. And so my friend told me, he's like, well, you just need a mental break and not have to get all caught up in this. And he goes, just do something you like doing you know, make a just and avoid doing things you don't like to do. And so I just did, I think I started with a blob. I think I was doing Metaballs, right? And I started with some blobs.
Oh, yeah.
I started with some blobs just to mess with, and then it started growing and growing. And then it exactly like you said, that whole thing of starting with some Metaballs turned it into a thesis that was very, very, you know, and I didn't know where it was going to go. It took me on a journey that I had no idea where it was going to go. And it was really fascinating to me to do that. And it sounds to me like you keep on building and building and building and building on the stuff, which is really kind of cool. I do want to touch on a couple things that you mentioned before. You mentioned video games, MMOs, and the fact that you possibly want to turn what you're creating into a video game or an experience of some kind. So first thing is what actual games were you playing? What were some of the games that really sort of got you to think about world building specifically?
I think the game that most got me thinking about world building was actually probably my very first game, which was RuneScape.
Oh yeah.
And the way that RuneScape did some things that made it feel more like a world than any other game. There was like item persistence. You could drop an item and it would show up on the ground and anyone could come pick it up.
Right.
You know, you didn't have to set up a trade. Like for example, World of Warcraft, which I also played, is something that it felt a lot less like a world to me.
Okay.
It was very, very much more on rails. Like you felt like it was more like a video game in a tunnel that you play with other people. Whereas RuneScape, they just dropped you in this place and the virtual economy was very robust and I got really into virtual economies and discovered my inner megalomaniac, you know? To me, the fact that, especially, you know, in the early days, it's kind of a wild west. It's like, you know, if you died, you could lose a lot.
Right.
You know? I'd say that one was probably the most worldly to me.
Interesting. Did you also play other games? Did you play games like Myst as well? Or have you ever played those games?
No, but what's funny is, like I said, I didn't play a lot of games growing up. But what's really interesting is that the game I'm working on now is pretty similar to Myst,
right?
In some ways, it's actually gameplay wise, if you play Myst Exile, the third one, mm-hmm. where you're basically every node you're in is you can look around in 360. That's basically kind of the navigation style of my game.
Okay.
I didn't actually grow up with Myst or I didn't play it. It was before my time.
Right. But I mean, I could see that because I'm looking at what you're doing is like, there's, you know, Myst is very much about exploring different places. And if I look at the images that are on your side, I could see that it's like, okay, this could be all about exploring. There's so much detail and so many places to go that this could be really, really interesting.
Is it about exploring? Yeah. It's about finding patterns. It's a big part of it.
So you're designing this game on your own. You're kind of doing an independent game on your own but with this idea.
Yes, but I do have help. I have a game designer who knows some coding, who's like, you know, who I'm hiring to help make the game. I have a great musician. He's going to help score the game, and I have some other artists who are also helping as well. So not a full solo endeavor.
Okay. So, well, that's really great. How long have you been working on this?
The actual idea really gelled at the beginning of this year.
Okay.
But I was doing freelance and a bunch of, I'm doing two other major projects at the same time. So, you know, I've made it in a couple different game engines, although I was still trying to figure out what the best platform for it was.
Right.
So I'm not, it's probably going to be another like year and a half before like the final is out.
Right. Right.
But yeah.
Well, it's fascinating. It's fascinating that you're doing that because I think it's definitely very interesting. I mean, I also, you know, I mentioned this to you earlier, but I really think that you need to get together with Kevin Mack. I think you and Kevin would just get along famously. You have very similar thought process and ideas and passion for the things you do. I think he's very much into his VR. Ideas as well, and I think did you said you were trying to look at Blortasia also
Oh, I already did. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we are already talking now.
Yes,
so thanks
yes.
again. Yep. Thanks again for introducing us.
Yeah, I think he's a great guy. He's also extraordinarily funny. He was was a fantastic person in the visual effects world, and he's done. He does not want to work in visual effects ever again. He wants to be an artist, and he thinks about his VR work exclusively. And I think that's a really cool idea. And I think that those are the types of things that need to be made right now. It's really nice to have those things being made, including, your game, I think would be really nice things to be made, because I think these are the kind of escapes that people need a little bit to experience that. I've actually started playing an MMO again recently that I haven't played in a long time. I started playing Guild Wars 2. And
oh yes, yeah, I played a bit of Guild Wars 2.
Yeah. And it's nice to just sort of like, you know what, I'm just going to go into that world for a couple of hours, and it's just going to be an escape, because I'm stuck at home as everyone else is, and so it's nice to sort of like be able to roam the countryside and interact with people.
I find it pretty interesting that I really believe that that more optimistic worlds and media are going to be bigger in the future.
Yeah.
I think we're already seeing it. When things are really, when things are fine and things are good, people seem to want to escape into disaster. It's like there's so much post-apocalyptic media and artwork out there, and I think when people are actually uncertain about the future, that they want more like comforting, more optimistic visions. And I think we really need that, because we're practicing for things to go wrong, in a sense. If too much of our media landscape is about all the different ways things can go wrong, it's like when you're driving a car, wherever you're looking, you're automatically going to kind of start steering towards.
Right.
And the idea of giving people like some kind of a beacon, some kind of a thing to look towards, especially young people. I really want my game to kind of inspire, young prospective engineers and designers to want to, make things, make designs that are more inspired by nature, and designs that can, help things be better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're 100% right. I mean, during the Great Depression, the 20s and 30s, movies were all about prosperity and everything else, right?
Exactly.
And so it's kind of the difference. And you're right, during the quote unquote good times, that's when we're dealing with horror films and all the other stuff. I actually think that there's a good part to dealing with horror films. Like, horror films is a way to process the memories of the horrors that happened in the past, right? It's a good way to sort of go through that immersive, therapy. And I think that's a good way to do it with art sometimes. But I think it's absolutely right to be able to say, here's a safe place for you to be where you can feel okay. And this is a good way for you to just be in a happy place to explore, is a wonderful thing. It's an absolutely wonderful thing. And I think it's really cool that you obviously 3D seems to be a big thing that allowed you to go from your drawing to just making more, right?
Oh yeah, I'm really glad that I'm alive and creating at this time. It's such an exciting time, because there's just so many amazing tools out there. Like, it's a force multiplier of creative energies. I can do things and try things so rapidly. Yeah, I love the building process of it. Again, that idea of being able to take previous assets and mix them together, and I can just amplify the complexity and like just orders of magnitude very quickly. Because I need to for the kind of world I'm making.
Yeah.
It's a world where novelty is almost like a kind of currency.
Yeah.
I'm really playing with the idea of post-scarcity, at least in this era. There's multiple eras. It spans a very long time.
Sure.
But I'm currently depicting the era that I'm calling the era of sunshine. I feel like that's been really underrepresented in art, like science fiction art.
Okay.
I have thoughts as to why that is. I think when it comes to things like video games, onboarding is important. You want people to immediately know what's going on. And if everything is so far future and so exotic that you don't even know, like, you know, what to do with anything, it's disorienting and confusing. And like my kind of, the kind of feeling that I like the idea of creating is like, I think I mentioned it on the 24 Hours of Chaos, is like you take a Neolithic adult, you know, fully developed brain, and you teleport that, you know, they're like from 140,000 years ago, and you teleport them to Times Square at night in 2020. You know, how would they process that?
Right.
You know, it would probably be a spiritual experience for them, you know, at first. And but like this person has never seen a rectangle before.
Right.
It's like, and so, yeah. So with video games, I think there's people tend to err on the side of relatability. As you see a lot of space marine corridors, there's rivets in the walls and everything, because people can pick up that gun and immediately know what they're supposed to do and where they're supposed to go.
Right.
And so I'm kind of turning that on its head with my game, because my game is about finding patterns and figuring out what thing to do. It's a little bit more like, you know, Myst, like, right. But it's even more exotic than Myst. It's like, it's about finding objects that have a common characteristic, where you think that they either have a similar design language, or they have, they seem to have a similar purpose based on the way they're constructed, and finding all those objects. And then when you found them all, you can, you know, figure out, you know, what they do and collect them. So it's, I'm kind of taking that onboarding problem and turning it into a game mechanic.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So just onboarding is the whole game in a lot of ways.
A little bit. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really.
You're actually playing a. Yeah.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. Sorry. You're playing an art historian from the very deep future, who's looking back at all these things that are still our future. So you're trying to figure out from limited. I call them snapshots. They're sort of like simulations. Mm-hmm. That's the art I'm making. You're trying to figure out from limited snapshots, like what the world was like at these different times. And civilization has changed so much, you know, up and down, that, you know, things are missing, and you have to, you know, you have to kind of figure things out based on what you have available.
That's really interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting. I mean, yes, because obviously a lot of people have to make all these assumptions based on some educated guesses of what they have. It was like, based on what I saw, this is what this is, right?
But being an archaeologist, and finding, you know, it's supposed to be kind of like that, but you're probing these very high-tech worlds. And what the best part about this is that, because you're an art and architecture, you're like an art and design historian. Mm-hmm. Best part about this is that I have created this home for all of my experimental artwork to live. And for other people's artwork, I'm going to license other artists' art as well.
Right.
Because, you know, all you have to do is create a narrative for how that art was relevant to that era.
Right.
And why it was, you know, hanging where it was. And so it's, you know, if I continue this franchise, I can just keep experimenting and doing all the stuff I love as an artist and actually have a home for it, which is, you know, so I'm really, really happy about how well that works out.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to touch a little bit, obviously, you know, because you have to create as much as you do, which is great. And 3D has helped you in a lot of ways iterate faster. In the world of rendering, obviously now there's been a lot more ideas of real-time rendering and how that has done. Mm-hmm. How has that affected you? Obviously your video game is in real time, but what do you think, like, how is that, as a creative, how does the real-time stuff work for you?
So this is the interesting thing about my game, is only a portion of it is in real time.
Oh.
So I ran into this problem pretty early, is that my personal vision, like, I, one of my mantras is I find beauty in complexity, and I will always push the complexity to the limit. And I found that with VR, at least in its current state, I could not get the kind of complexity that I wanted. There's no way it would work with real time. So the way I'm solving this is that there is a hub. The main part of the game, the backbone of the game, is that you are running this museum in a time when nobody even knows really what a museum is.
Right.
We're kind of bringing back this past idea of a museum. And so that part is in real time. That will be made in Unreal Engine. And the great thing about that is it's indoors. And because it's a museum, the idea is museums are trying to be kind of fair in their complexity, so that they can let the objects show through. So I think real time will be totally, you know, pretty doable for that. But the actual worlds that you're playing, the pattern finding mm-hmm. puzzle part of the game, those are all pre-rendered.
Mm.
So I'm rendering both equirectangular and cube maps depending on the content.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually compatible for smartphone VR if that ever comes back again.
Right.
And Oculus Quest. So it's a very lightweight VR compatible thing. But okay. I don't have a lot of interest in real time rendering unless it's actually going to be in the game.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting. I'd be curious. I mean, it may not necessarily be appropriate for, you know, like you said, in-game VR and stuff, but I'd be curious to see the ability for, because obviously your creations are massively amount, lots of geometry, tons and tons and tons of geometry, right? So,
yeah.
Which is what some of the real-time challenges you are dealing with rasterization. But I'm curious, have you tried to actually bring any of them into Vantage or what used to be Project Lavina?
I have actually.
Yeah.
And it worked out pretty well, except for there's some, I use a rather not, I use an aspect of V-Ray a lot, which is proxy objects that are not meshes. They're like point clouds. They don't have support for that in that project yet. Yeah. I already went on forums and asked about it and they're, I was getting some funky results, but it is a very niche thing. Like the reason I'm very into point clouds right now, because my world, one of the central aspects of this part of the world is having millions and billions of little microbots, dimensional microbots mm-hmm. that self-assemble back to emergence and modularity.
Right.
And so I found that point clouds were the best solution because they render so quick in V-Ray, like incredibly quick for the amount of, and I love how like each point is a dimensional. It casts a shadow, it gets a light. Yeah. I can put a material on each point, you know, that can have fall off maps, all this crazy stuff. So they're perfect for me, but they're very niche kind of
right.
A,
yeah, not many people are going to use this on a day-to-day basis.
I have this crazy pipeline where I can take meshes and turn them into point clouds, which nobody ever wants to do. I was trying to figure out how to do this. Everyone wants to take point cloud and make it a mesh.
Right, you want to take the other way around. That's really cool, though. Yeah, no, but I'm curious, because you know, there's a lot of complexity, and I want to see you iterate as fast as possible, as many ways as possible, and I think like whatever we can do that. Now, obviously, like that's a complex thing that would have to be solved for you specifically. But I am curious about you going to a fully ray traced world, because I think that that's going to be able, you're going to be able to get a lot more geometry if you go fully ray traced, which is.
Well, one of my issues is also translucency.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so I've been doing a lot more with plane mapping.
Mm-hmm.
And so like taking lots of planes, stacking them, putting translucency, which is like the recipe for long renders.
Yeah.
As like, you know, like, Unreal does not like that.
But those problems will get solved. So we're eventually technology is going to catch up to your brain, but it's going to take a while because I think your brain is moving faster than technology is, which is great, which is wonderful. I think that the fact that we can be part of this journey with you is really kind of cool, really great.
Yeah.
And I think okay, so I do want to, you know, bring up, you know, obviously you've done this, you've thought about this, you're creating world, you're doing amazing, or freelancing for a bunch of people. Then I want to go back to what we talked about at the beginning and go full circle here and go back to like giving back to the community and teaching people about your process and doing that. Obviously, Twitch came along, that came out of the gaming world, which is also true. What do you think about, you know, now there's a growing group of people that are putting art and creating art on Twitch, and you're amongst that group. By the way, where can people find you on Twitch? What's your channel so people can go check it out?
It's just my last name, Kristen Zerngubel. I try to make it simple.
Okay.
So yeah, all my socials are just Person Zerngubel.
Right.
As far as I know, there's only one of me. So
good. I'm not, well, good. Well, then you will be easy to find. But what do you, you know? So tell us about that process of going to Twitch and what that's been like for you.
So I'm trying multiple platforms. So I'm using something called Restream that broadcasts me simultaneously to Facebook, Twitter, and Twitch. I've enjoyed it. It's difficult to get a following going at first, and I've tried streaming all different aspects. I've done watercolor painting. I've done the really rough brainstorming work, which is the most fun part to me. I think one of the challenging things with streaming that kind of thing is that if someone just pops in and they don't have the context of what you've been working on, I think it's more difficult for them to get into it. I think, when someone's rendering the really shiny painting, instantly people can know what they're doing and like get into it. And so, you know, if I'm doing some rough sketch and they don't know like what kind of problem I'm trying to solve with this Zeppelin and why it has like these things sticking out of it, I have to keep reminding people like, you know, what I'm doing. So maybe making videos for YouTube is actually better because I can just put everything together. And just getting an audience for Twitch is difficult. You know, you have to stream like all day, like multiple days in a row to really start like building up that that following. I found a really good way to reach out to the community better than streaming has actually been like Discord.
Oh, interesting.
Like the chat. So I have a Discord server, and so you can find it if you go to entopolis.com, which is my game project, or just my website. And that's great because like you can hang out with people in there. You can stream to. It's a more closed community, sure, but anyone with the link can join. So so there's a bunch of other creators in there, and we kind of all share things together, and that's been something I've been putting more energy into lately than like Twitch and streaming.
Nice.
It's nice.
I think it's great. I think it's really important to people to have a community and people and find people that you know have similar thoughts and be able to continue thought. I started a second podcast that I do with two of my friends called Martini Giant, and we talk about some of our favorite. We're big film nerds, and we talk about movies for like three. We talk about a 1 hour, 2 hour movie for over 3 hours. So we tend to be a little prolific, so we started looking at Twitch as well as an idea of, and we started finding a few people that come in and join in on the conversation. And it's completely changed a little bit about how we do, because some people are like, oh yeah, that's a cool film, you know, whatever that is. And having that interaction with those people kind of makes you feel like, oh, okay, I'm not the only person with those thoughts, you know? And that's kind of a nice, that's a really nice way to reach out to the community. And then that person probably says the same thing when they hear you say it. They're like, oh, why? I've had those thoughts as well, you know? It's really great. And so that's a really cool thing that you're able to do with your community and to reach out to them and to do those types of things. So, pretty great.
I'd really like to involve them in the game directly. It's like, if someone makes artwork, if they can come up with a way that fits into my world, I'll put it in the game and I'll credit them and they will be in the lore. I can use their real name and say like, this person made this work, you know, during this tumultuous period in this place. And, you know, like I love the idea of kind of bringing others into the work.
Have you thought much about the metaverse?
Metaverse.
Okay, so metaverse is the term that Tim Sweeney came up with. Well, he's not the only one to use that term, but anyway, Tim Sweeney, obviously the founder of Epic, and he's thinking about like Fortnite right now as a game, but he sees it as, you know, Ready Player One at some point. You know what I mean? And so the idea of your, you know, your world and your art and your things existing inside of a completely, you know, created world of your own creation. It's like, it'd be very much like you creating a world that creates a world that creates a world that this exists in.
Oh no, believe me, people in my world are creating lots of worlds.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I absolutely think in those terms. I'm glad you asked that question. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. It's
I think it's really cool. Okay, so as we're winding down here, I want to get, you know, make sure people can check out your stuff. So you'll go ahead and tell us what, you know, obviously you said your all your social channels is just your name, and that's a much easier way to do it. So they'll have to look up how they spell your name and do that. But also, you know, your website as well is where you see all your art. Oh, perfect. Look at that. There you go.
There we go. Hopefully it gets into focus here.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
It's all right. We will say that on the website itself, and in the YouTube description, we will put all those links for you. So that will be there. And then obviously your website is another big one, which has a lot of your artwork. And I highly, highly encourage people to go check out your website and see some of the incredible, incredible work that you've done there.
Just kristenzirngebol.com, and just try to type in an approximation of my last name and Google will probably autocorrect it for you.
There you go. That's perfect. That's perfect, Kirsten. I really appreciate your time. This has been wonderful.
It has. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me.